I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's here and now. It's been 1 year since Iran's disputed presidential election and what was thought to be the start of a popular movement that challenged the 30-year-old Islamic Republic. Since the election, the government has taken strong action. Hundreds of people have been arrested, dozens killed in a crackdown on the so-called Green Movement, and opposition leaders have called off a planned demonstration to mark the anniversary this weekend. With us is Nazila Fati, who covers Iran for the New York Times. And Nazila, will the anniversary be marked at all inside Iran?
Well, inside Iran, the opposition leaders called off the protest, as you said, partly because the authorities have brought in thousands of forces to confront any kind of demonstrations. But on the other hand, some other opposition groups, which also call themselves as Green Movement, they have said that they will go ahead and stage protests, not only in Tehran, but also in other cities. In the meantime, Iranians all over the world, I think in over 80 cities, are holding events in consolidation with Iranians inside the country.
There are some who say that the opposition is sort of divided and rather leaderless, and maybe that's a reason why things aren't exactly clear right now for folks who may think differently than the government.
People who have come under the umbrella of the so-called Green Movement have diverse demands. Some of them demand the overthrowing of the regime altogether, and some of them just want reform within the current system. So in many ways, its leadership is not very clear. It doesn't have a political agenda. But that does not mean that the dissent is not there, that the opposition is dead, or it's not capable of moving forward. At this stage, they are not capable of mustering large protests in the same way that they did last year, particularly because the suppression and the scale of brutality has been extremely bad, and it doesn't make sense to people to come out and make huge sacrifices.
Is it also, though, does it say something about the strength of Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad? Because if you look not just at how this opposition has been handled, he basically says, I'm not going to tolerate the opposition. He's also said, I'm not going to listen to the United Nations, which recently imposed new sanctions against Iran. And we just heard today that the three U.S. hikers who are going to be on trial for espionage, that they will, in fact, be tried soon in Iran. So all of these things look like a strength on the part of Mr. Ahmadinejad, yes or no?
Well, I mean, you can call it strength or you can say defiance. The fact of the matter is that the government had been able to suppress other protests in the past. What happened was every time they were suppressed, they reemerged a few years later, only in larger numbers, and people were angrier and more frustrated. So we have to just wait and see what this anger and frustration that is simmering beneath the surface is going to lead to.
So overall, would you say that life has changed dramatically since last year's elections?
Life has politically changed for many people. A lot of people have been killed. At least about 70 people have been killed. The families of these people are more angry, are more frustrated. In the meantime, hundreds of people have been jailed. A lot of people have been forced to leave the country. And this affects their relatives back home, their colleagues back home. In those sense, I think the core of the regime has been shaken. The divisions within the establishment have increased. You see people like Mr. Karoubi, Mr. Mousavi, Mr. Rafsanjani, who were among the founders of the revolution and now are being called opposition leaders. So politically, we are faced with a totally different landscape.
What about for average Iranians, for an average Iranian citizen? Do they notice that life has changed in the past year?
Of course, yeah. The scale of suppression has increased even on a social level. Just in this month, we saw that the Iranian government started a new campaign to suppress younger people over what they wear, over how they appear in public. They came up with three different police squads that were after women who were not Islamically dressed or people who were playing music in their cars or young men and women who appeared in public without being married. These are things that affect people very directly.
And music has really been a way for folks to sort of register their views, yes?
Yes. Music has been one of those things that has managed to sort of voice dissent, especially by musicians overseas, and they've been very popular inside the country.
New York Times Iran correspondent Nazila Fati, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
We want to turn now to Iran's movie industry. It's thriving, producing films to national and international acclaim, and that's despite some government interference. Filmmaker Jafar Panahi was freed on bail in Iran last week. He was arrested in March on unspecified security charges and received international attention when organizers of the Cannes Film Festival, where Panahi was supposed to be a juror, spoke out against his detention and called it an attack on art. Nigar Motahede is author of the book Displaced Allegories, Post-Revolutionary Iranian Cinema, and she's a professor at Duke University in North Carolina. She's joining us on the line from Spain, where she's currently on sabbatical. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
Let's start with Panahi. How popular is he, and what was he arrested for?
Panahi was making a film about the presidential elections that happened in the summer of 2009, and about the amazing uprising of Iranian people in protest against the outcome of the elections. And so his film was supposedly about what happened during the elections and the aftermath of the elections.
He's in Iran right now?
Yes, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Has he spoken out?
You know what? I have not read anything by him since he was released.
Tell me, aside from this movie that he was making about the protest movement in Iran and the presidential election, what types of movies did he make?
The first film that won a prize at the Cannes Film Festival was a film called The White Balloon, which was a story about a little girl who wanted to buy herself a goldfish on the Persian New Year. But what happened as she went in search of the goldfish was that what we would see in the background, the life of middle and lower classes in Iran, a portrayal of the life and entertainment and relations of the lower classes in Iran. He made several others. The Circle was about the life of middle and lower class women in Iran, and it's really from birth to death, from birth to imprisonment of several women.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most popular films that he made was called Offside. This film was about female fans who wanted to watch the World Cup, to watch a football game in Iran.
Were they allowed to watch a football game?
Certainly not.
Right. So can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So they snuck in disguise, and they were caught. It's about their conversation, about their enthusiasm about soccer.
So it seems as if Panahi really took on a lot of social themes, and it was almost like social commentary in a lot of his films. Some of them banned in Iran, not all of them.
If you pay attention to the background of his film, there is a great deal more social commentary than you see at first sight.
Are his films popular in Iran? Can you get them even?
Yes, they are. I would say that just as social commentary in the United States is popular with a certain group of people, social commentary is interesting to a certain group of Iranians as well. I wouldn't say that the majority are really interested in social commentary. They live that life every day. So what they want, like everybody else, is entertainment.
And how do people get them if they're banned?
Well, there is a huge black market.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy them in DVD stores, under the counter, on the streets. And people generally know how to get everything that's disallowed through the black market, including alcohol and drugs.
So are American or European films more popular, would you say?
I don't know necessarily that they're more popular, but they are very popular and also available on the black market. The more popular blockbuster films are available within a day or two in Iran as well, on the streets.
So are there government controls then on American and European films that make it impossible for some of the big blockbusters to be shown in Iran? And can you explain what some of those rules are about what types of movies are allowed?
Since the establishment of the Islamic Republic in 1979, a certain number of rules started governing the production of films themselves. So, for example, one thing in particular was a system of modesty that was imposed on the representation of men and women on screen. This had particular repercussions on the representation of the body of women. Women had to be veiled. They had to be shown in long shot and not in movement that would show the contours of their bodies. That makes a huge difference in the way that filmmakers had used their camera. They couldn't do close-ups. Close-ups generally show emotions, right? And they're used to represent conversation in shot reverse shot patterns and so forth. The idea was that if you had a close-up of a woman, an unrelated man in the theater would feel as if he was in close contact with the woman in close-up on screen. And this would constitute an immodest relationship between a Muslim man and a Muslim woman. So the close-up was prohibited on the grounds that it was immodest in its representation. The veil also prohibits a certain kind of three-dimensionality to an image. It's very hard to light a black head covering, something that covers you from head to toe. So filmmakers had to find creative ways of capturing the female body in modest clothes. As a result of this, a lot of early Iranian films were set in rural areas where women could be represented realistically in modest clothing, because rural women work, and they work outdoors, and they have colorful outfits rather than black, you know, chadors. And so the rural environment and rural lives became the kind of thematic that dominated Iranian films in the early years of the film industry after the Islamic Revolution.
What about right now? What's popular right now, would you say, among Iranians?
Hollywood films in general, anything that, you know, when I was back in Iran about 4 years ago, the last Tarantino movie, the Kill Bill movie, was very popular, and it was just out. So it is whatever, you know, whatever is on the market right now that is most popular in the States is what is popular also in Iran.
How important is the film industry in Iran right now?
Film has become an important export, a product for export from Iran, just like pistachios or oil. In the early years of the revolution, film was highly popular in Iran because Iranians didn't have any other kind of entertainment. And Iranian films were the only films that were being made. Since the coming of satellite television, since the rise of the black market, since the opening up of Iran to the foreign film industry, I think the popularity of Iranian films has gone down.
Negar Motahedeh, author of Displaced Allegories, Post-Revolutionary Iranian Cinema. She's also a professor at Duke University in North Carolina, and she joined us on the line from Spain, where she's currently on sabbatical. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Deb.
Just ahead, the opening game at the World Cup in South Africa has just finished. Only a Game's Bill Littlefield will join us. And later in the show, journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates goes back to school. Back in a minute. Here and now.
And here comes Shabalala. He's got a chance here. My goodness. What a fantastic goal for South Africa. What a way to open the scoring in the 2010 World Cup.
Soccer or football fans of the world rejoice. Today, as we just heard, the World Cup began in dramatic fashion with the home team South Africa's goal in the opener against Mexico. Mexico came back, however, and the match ended in a 1-1 tie. Joining us to talk about the game and what's ahead in the World Cup is soccer fan and host of NPR's Only a Game, Bill Littlefield. And Bill, South Africa put up a great show today.
Well, they scored the first goal in their own World Cup, the first time the World Cup has ever occurred on the African continent. You can't ask for too much more than that, except they would have been even happier if Mexico hadn't tied them late in the game.
and tomorrow, of course, it's the U.S. meeting England in the first round. And, of course, many people remember that game back, that early round match back in 1950 when the U.S. beat a heavily favored England. Any chance of a repeat there?
Well, I don't know how many people remember it at this point. people of a certain age like me, perhaps. But certainly people have heard a lot about it over the last couple of weeks. It would be a tremendous accomplishment if the U.S. were to knock off England in their first game, but it would not be quite the upset that that 1950 game constituted, because that U.S. team was a bunch of kind of day laborers who had been cobbled together for a trip to Latin America. No, it wouldn't be quite the same. We have Landon Donovan, we have Clint Dempsey, we have Tim Howard. It's a team that with guys who have international experience and have, in some cases, played very well overseas.
And who do you think we should watch for to win?
That game, we should certainly watch for the U.S. to win. I'm not sure it's going to happen, but there will be broken hearts and heads banging off the wall in England if it doesn't turn out that England wins.
One more very quick prediction. Celtics-Lakers last night. What do you think lies ahead?
Why, it's a series now. How exciting. if only we can find some other unlikely hero like Glenn Davis for two more games out of the next three, the Celtics would be all set.
All right. Well, NPR is only a game. NPR only a game. Bill Littlefield, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Deb.
Well, let's go back to South Africa now, where World Cup action did get underway today, and security is a top concern. We have this report from the BBC's Karen Allen.
Diplomats from England and the US stage a football friendly just days before the World Cup. It's a light-hearted foretaste of the match to come on June the 12th, when the two teams go head-to-head near Rustenburg. With US Vice President Joe Biden expected in the crowd, along with a ministerial presence from London, this is being seen as a high-risk match in security terms. But the US ambassador to South Africa, Donald Gibbs, has played down the threat.
In addition to working closely with all the countries who have teams coming to the games, we're working very closely with the South Africans and sharing everything we know. We've been doing trainings with them to get them prepared.
In the past few weeks, there have been a series of contradictory security reports coming out of the US, one suggesting the presence of Somali training camps in neighboring Mozambique and Al-Qaeda cells in South Africa. The other, from the CIA intelligence gathering company Stratfor, suggesting any jihadist activities here are extremely unlikely. Nevertheless, last year, the US embassy was forced to close briefly after intelligence operatives intercepted a telephone call between an alleged Al-Qaeda sympathizer in Mogadishu and a contact just outside Cape Town. So what are analysts making of all this on the ground?
Border control is probably one of the major issues. Also the question of South African passports being utilized. And then the next question of corruption.
Annelie Botha is a senior researcher from Pretoria's Institute of Security Studies. She says South Africa has some areas that make it vulnerable, but cautions that any country hosting such a prominent event becomes a target. Little surprise, then, that for the past couple of months, intelligence reports of suspect activity have made their way into the media.
The first one starting in early April, in which the AQLM in Algeria mentioned on a website planning the match between United States and the UK, for example. Then the plot, or alleged plot, from Iraq, that again proved to be not really a plot, but more discussion between friends. In that case, the Dutch and the Danish teams were mentioned. There's all of these bits and pieces of information flying around, raising the threat level. And I think that through this, we're playing into the hands of the terrorists.
In the past few weeks, the police have staged demonstrations to show they're prepared for any kind of attack. And a major operations hub has been established, bringing together military, intelligence and police units. Recent reports coming out of Baghdad suggesting that a prominent Al-Qaeda activist was planning to target the Dutch and Danish matches at the World Cup have been broadly dismissed. And Nathi Tetwa, South Africa's Minister of Police, says the threat of terrorist violence and unease in the Somali community is baseless.
We've been working with the security agencies, both intelligence and otherwise, of other countries. We have been working on a continuous basis, monitoring things. Basically, we've been chasing ghosts, sent from pillar to post. We've sent the head of intelligence, for instance. We sent them to Iraq some 2 weeks ago after these things came. There's absolutely nothing.
I've come to meet one of the foremost Islamic scholars in South Africa, Professor Iqbal Jazbai. He argues that unlike other parts of the continent, South Africa's institutions have sought to embrace the Somali community and in so doing have insulated the country to a certain extent against attacks from militant groups such as Somalia's Al-Shabaab.
Well, if we look at the vibrant Somali community in South Africa, there is the likelihood of some members of militant Islamic groups like Al-Shabaab who have possibly made their way through South Africa. But if we look at a broader picture of the Somali community in South Africa, they've done exceptionally well economically as entrepreneurs in the major cities in the countryside. And I don't think they would want to disrupt that.
South African intelligence services has successfully infiltrated right-wing supremacist groups that have also made threats to disrupt the World Cup. But with more than 300,000 visitors expected on South African soil, the country will be on high alert for the month ahead.
That report from the BBC's Karen Allen. This note about Monday on Here and Now, Robin speaks with Sebastian Younger about life and death with a combat platoon in Afghanistan. That's Monday. Still ahead today, musicals about music. It's the latest trend on Broadway. The news is next, Here and Now. Scientists have long been aware that there's a lot behind the saying, led by the nose. And now marketers are hoping to capitalize on what the nose knows. Realizing that smell strongly affects the way we think and act, many marketers are using scent to try to lure consumers. A scented billboard advertising beef in North Carolina emits the smell of grilled steak during rush hour. Joining us to talk about this is psychologist Avery Gilbert. He's author of What the Nose Knows, The Sense of Smell in Everyday Life. Welcome.
Thank you, Deborah.
So what do you think of a billboard that smells like grilled steak?
I'm hungry thinking about it.
Really?
Actually. What's unique about this one is just the size of the undertaking, the fact that they're pumping out enough grilled steak smell to capture cars on the freeway.
Don't you think that could turn some people off, especially at like 7 a.m.?
Yeah, I was wondering about the morning traffic. Afternoon, that would totally grab me. I'd be on the way to buy some lighter fluid, but you're passing it at some rate of speed, and you'll get a whiff or two, and it's a serving suggestion, no more.
What do we know about how smell influences the way we think and the way we behave? Can it really make people want to buy things and hurry up and get out to the grill?
It can activate a string of mental associations, and I think that's the most fundamental part of it. What we forget about is that there's a whole brain behind the nose. And as my argument in my book is that people are really thinking about smells all the time. You come across an odd smell or a smell you haven't encountered in a while, and you're trying to put it in context. You're always trying to make sense of it. If it's at a low level or a high level, you kind of sniff it, and is this the right smell? Or if you're trying a new product, a new kind of shampoo in the grocery store, you know, does this smell right? Will my husband like it? Are the kids going to like it? Does this smell, you know, expensive enough for the price that it is? You're doing a lot of thinking about it, and if you can get that into the equation, then marketers can be very happy in using it as another way to present their product.
You know, I was looking at a list. There was almost a chart that said that certain smells are associated with certain emotions. So, for example, when people smell talcum powder, they feel safe.
There are certain general classes of smells that have certain kinds of emotional directions, I would say. But I think people have overplayed the emotionality of smell as a sense for a long time. You know, the idea that we smell something, our ears kind of perk up and our nostrils flare, and that we immediately go into some emotional state about it. I think it's more subtle than that. You know, it can put you in the mood of eating. Fragrances can, some sense of relaxing, some might put you a little bit on edge. So it all depends what you want to do with your scent if you're a marketer.
Give me an example of a smell that might put somebody on edge and a smell that might make somebody relax.
Well, I mean, I've worked on these kind of briefs in the fragrance industry before. So, for example, if you have a shower gel and people are going to be taking a shower in the morning and the positioning is energizing and invigorating, well, you want it to smell that way. So you'd probably start with things like citrus notes, grapefruit. They tend to be seen, perceived as invigorating. You wouldn't put a lavender smell in there. But if you wanted an air freshener for the bedroom, then I'd think about lavender and other kind of very, you know, heavier, more relaxing kinds of smells. People perceive them that way. We can determine that by testing.
I also read that, you wanted somebody to think that a room was actually bigger than it was, the smell of cucumber or apple might help.
I've seen references to that. I believe there's even a patent application for certain smells making space seem bigger, and that doesn't actually seem so crazy to me. I mean, how often have you gone into, say, you know, a small room that's got a kind of closed, musty smell to it? I think it makes it feel more claustrophobic than it is. By reverse logic, you could probably have a fresh smell or maybe something outdoorsy that would suggest to your brain that this is a bigger room than it is.
Give me an interesting example of what some companies might be doing to use the smell to have them their company or their brand associated with it.
It's becoming quite popular in the hospitality industry. So you've got hotel chains that are trying to differentiate themselves from one another on price and kind of style and how they're outfitted. And they're using smells now, kind of a corporate logo scent, if you will. So you walk into the lobby and they have a very low level of scent that, again, ties into the decor, ties into the finishing. Are there rugs? Is it cool colors, calm colors, or whatever? And they just use that as another element in their presentation.
Psychologist Avery Gilbert, he's author of the book What the Nose Knows, The Science of Smell in Everyday Life. Thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome, Deborah. Thank you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
It's an age-old question. How do you keep young students engaged in school? Our next guest poses that question from both a professional and personal perspective. Ta-Nehisi Coates recently wrote about a middle school program in New York called School of One. It's now an after-school math program that customizes lesson plans for each student, and it's being expanded this fall. Some have described it as the future of American education. Coates' visit there made him wonder if such a program might have helped him. By his own admission, he was not the greatest student, and he ended up dropping out of college. But by many measures, he's now a success. He's senior editor for The Atlantic and author of the memoir, The Beautiful Struggle. And Ta-Nehisi Coates joins me from the studios of NPR New York. Welcome to Here and Now.
Oh, thanks for having me, Deb.
You write in your Atlantic essay recently that somewhere around the fourth grade, you started fantasizing about dropping out of school. Why did you start thinking about that so early, do you think?
I think I had a basic inability to sit still and pay attention. Mm-hmm. And I never completely understood why. That was part of why I wanted to do the article. I think it's interesting. I grew up in a household where school was basically everything. It was the only source of really parental approval. You know, it was the source of your self-esteem in terms of what was important when you went home. And I think by the time I got to about the fourth grade, I was figuring out I wasn't doing too well at it, and I probably wasn't going to do too well at it as I moved into the future.
So what happened, basically?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. My parents basically grabbed me by the collar and dragged me through the next, 8 years of school. And a question I've always wondered myself is, had I not had them, what would have happened to me? And so it was a matter of my mother sending notes to school, constantly coming up school to check in with my teachers, checking my homework, looking after, to make sure I was at least making an attempt to do my work. I went back to Baltimore to do a reading for the book. And whenever I go back and I go to a school and I meet teachers, I always feel the urge to apologize because I don't know that I could have been any different, and I don't know that they could have done anything any different.
Right. Well, so you made it through high school. You did graduate.
Yes, I did.
And then didn't quite make it through college, but eventually turned around.
Yeah. Although, it's funny. When you were saying earlier, by all measures, that I'm a success, I always say there's still time for that to turn around, too. Life is tricky. We'll see.
So you have these questions in the back of your mind. What would you have done had you not had parents who put such a high priority on education? And you take it to this middle school in the South Bronx, this School of One. Tell me about School of One and what you saw there.
Well, I thought one of the big puzzles for me was that even though I wasn't particularly enthusiastic about school, I was always extremely enthusiastic about learning and could spend a great deal of time reading and, studying up on things. It was the classroom aspect as it was set up. And so the intriguing thing about School of One, to me, was that they were trying to teach kids math, but that they were teaching kids' math according to the way in which they felt the kid would be best able to receive the information. So one of the problems that we have in education is if you have a classroom and you have 30 kids, you have to find a way to teach as many of those kids as possible. And I think it's a real challenge to educators to reach an entire group of kids who may be at A, different levels, and B, just have different ways of acquiring information. I think that that's always a challenge. And so one of the ways School of One adapts to that challenge is through the use of technology, actually tailor-making a curriculum towards a child.
So basically, the students are in this sort of open classroom on computers, and they're all sort of working on their own lesson plan, individualized lesson plan that will help tap into their strengths as learners so they can get the information.
Yeah, and I should add, some of them are working on computers. Some of them are actually working in a traditional way with a teacher. Some of them are working in groups together. It really just depends on the kid. There's a diagnostic given at the beginning of the session to see where the child is in terms of the subject matter, but also how the child might be best in terms of acquiring information. After each session, there's another diagnostic given to see how the kid progressed. Did they acquire the skills they expected them to acquire? And what adjustments can be made for the next day?
Mm-hmm. And so overall, in these after-school programs, has the testing shown that the kids are doing well?
Yeah, I think the real test will be, though, for this coming year when they move from... So the first phase was as the summer program. The second phase was to expand to 3 schools as an after-school program. This year, they're actually going to replace the math curriculum in the school with School of One. So I think that'll be the big test. And I think, you know, over the course of years, as they try to fine-tune it, figure out what works, what doesn't, we'll get a sense. It's tough because we're in this environment where people want solutions now. And it's not always clear that solutions now can be given, that we know immediately what works and why it does work.
When I read your essay and I listened to you talk about this, I'm kind of curious about this algorithm that designs these playlists or these lesson plans for children. They call them playlists in the school. This is relying on a mathematical formula, really.
Right.
Can that really capture what an individual student needs?
Right. Well, I think, again, that so far it's been effective, but I'm trying not to oversell this, right? Because we just don't know. And I think while it's promising, I think over time we'll see and we'll know more. As I said, they haven't actually gone into the classroom and actually replaced math as it's traditionally taught yet. This year, they'll be doing that. And I'll be very interested to see how that turns out.
Now, you know, in your essay, you write that this school obviously made you wonder if it's what you would have needed when you were in school. Maybe as you describe it, maybe all you needed was a warm hug from a cold algorithm. Do you think that this would have helped you? Because, you know, you also told us during our conversation that you feel like apologizing to some of your former teachers in Baltimore. You don't know if you could have been any different. So I suppose that's the question, right?
Yeah, and I had, you know, I feel like I really had teachers that really, really cared and, you know, would always come up to me and tell me I was so smart, I was this, I was that, how could I be this bad in school? So I feel bad. I think, look, there are 2 things. I think it probably would have helped because I think you get much more individualized attention with the School of One method. But, you know, I'm also kind of old school. I have a little bit of my parents in me, and I don't know if that creeped into the essay, but I also wonder whether I was just lazy, you know, like that's still in the back of my head, that maybe I was just lazy, you know.
And maybe you just couldn't sit still.
Yeah, maybe I just couldn't sit still. But for the record, to this day, I still can't sit still. I still have problems with that today.
All right. Well, Ta-Nehisi Coates, senior editor at The Atlantic, will link you to his essay about the School of One at our website, hereandnow.org. Ta-Nehisi, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me, Deb.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back.
Oh, Lord, I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved. Just like a tree that's growing in the meadow.
Down by the water.
I shall not be moved.
Well, there's nothing new about rock musicals, but the latest phenomenon on Broadway is musicals all about music. With the Tonys airing this Sunday, Here and Now critic at large Ed Siegel joins us to talk about this trend. Hello there, Ed.
Hi, Deb. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too. Ed, these are familiar voices we're hearing, aren't they?
Yeah, you said it. That's the Million Dollar Quartet. Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins. And if you listen really, really closely, you just might be able to hear Johnny Cash. It's 1956, and these guys have gathered at the Sun Recording Studios in Memphis. They started jamming after a Carl Perkins session where he recorded Matchbox and other things. And the reason why you have to strain to hear Cash is because he apparently stood too far from the microphone, so it didn't pick him up.
So this is a musical about a jam session.
Yeah, not quite. The recording session had them singing mostly gospel songs and other people's songs and traditional pieces. The Broadway musical is really about the rise and fall of Sam Phillips, the founder of Sun Records, and the 50s Fab Four cutting loose more on their greatest hits than other people's songs.
On December 4th, 1956, one man brought Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, and Elvis Presley to play together for the first and only time. That man was me, Sam Phillips. The place was Sun Records. And that night, we made rock and roll history.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready.
Well, now go, cat, go,
but don't you step on our blue suede shoes. Well, you can do anything, but lay off of my blue suede shoes.
So, Ed, what'd you think?
I thought it was really enjoyable. The instrumentation in Million Dollar Quartet is just great. The four musicians are excellent. The sound mix is the cleanest you're ever going to hear in with a live rock music show. And here's an example. Just listen to how Levi Christ handles the Jerry Lee Lewis hit, Real Wild Child.
All right, well, that's Million Dollar Quartet, but we're not only hearing music for boomers, are we?
No, not at all.
Don't want to be an American idiot. Don't want a nation under the new media.
And that is the American Idiot, based on the Green Day album.
Right, Deb? It's a high-voltage blast that's both a faithful and imaginative staging of that CD about contemporary post-9/11 alienation with the political and social mores of the day. It's this generation's Tommy.
And it works?
Yeah, absolutely, Deb. Whatever you think of Green Day's music, the direction by Michael Mayer is phenomenal. This has the same energy as another rock musical he directed, Spring Awakening. It has a similar punk choreography, particularly in the song Extraordinary Girl, where a soldier serving in Iraq has a mid-air dance with a nurse he's hallucinating about.
Ed, you mentioned dancing. Famous choreographers are big this year, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Twyla Tharp, who turned Billy Joel's music into a Broadway mega hit and Bob Dylan's into a mega failure, she's back with another pop music icon.
These little town blues.
Tharp did a ballet arrangement of Frank Sinatra's songs many years ago, didn't she?
Yeah, with Baryshnikov, and that was terrific. Come Fly Away, not so much.
Excuse the pun, Come Fly Away didn't soar?
No, it did not. We're talking Sinatra here, so the source music is great. But these other musicals, whatever their pros and cons, they capture the essence of the musicians that they're paying homage to. Part of the problem with Come Fly Away is that, unlike the other musicals, There's no synergy between the players here. The band and the dancers, they're just reacting to an echoey mix of Sinatra's music. The dancing's smart, but it doesn't take your breath away.
I'm gonna roll myself up in a big ball and die. My.
What about another big choreographer with a Broadway show?
Now you're talking.
Yes. You dance very well. Now, Calacuta will dance for you.
That's from Bill T. Jones' Fela, the story about Fela Kuti, the Nigerian Afrobeat pioneer. And this one has all the great musicianship of Million Dollar Quartet and the energy of American Idiot combined with Bill T. Jones' exquisite choreography, African-inspired choreography. Here we really feel as if the man's roots are being honored and that we have a front-row seat in his nightclub, The Shrine.
I am Fela Anikulapo Kuti, he who carries death in his pouch, who no mortal can ever kill. So let us turn Nigeria upside down. The police will try and shut me down, but the government won't dare come near me. I am the law and will do what I please. So yeah, man. Make me your next black president.
Fela Kuti was also a political activist. How does the show handle that?
Well, Deb, he opposed the military rule and fought for democracy, including, in his case, the right to marry 27 women.
Whoops.
including his singers and dancers. But here the Tony-nominated Sara and Gauja and the dancers are satirizing the thoughtlessness of army recruits he refers to as zombies.
Zombie went on one way, a door to die, a door to. Zombie went on one way, a door to die, a door. Ha!
There's a tendency to gloss over things like Fela and AIDS, which is what killed him, but boy, the virtues really outweigh the flaws here.
Well, how do you think, Ed, that all these musicals about music affect the Tonys?
Well, you know, interestingly, none of these are up for best score because they didn't use original music. But the three I like, they're all nominated for best musical along with another show about the birth of rock and roll called Memphis.
And who are you rooting for?
I am rooting for Fela. That's the one that got everybody out of their seats.
Well, then, let's go out with a little more from Fela. Thanks very much, Ed.
My pleasure, Deb.